you have more states that started nuclear weapons programs and verifiably gave them up than we have states with nuclear weapons, which means our efforts to talk countries out of it succeed more often than they fail, even in the fairly rare cases where countries start down the road in the first place.
Shortly following the vast destruction that two bombs wrought upon Hiroshima and Nagasaki in 1945, a group of scientists at the University of Chicago, physicists who had actively worked on the Manhattan Project, worried about the catastrophic power they had unleashed on the world. So they started a journal to discuss and debate the consequences of the atomic age, called the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists. And in 1947, they released an issue featuring one of the Cold War's most iconic images, the Doomsday Clock. At first, the clock was pegged at just 7 minutes to midnight, and in the ensuing decades, it's risen and fallen as geopolitics have shifted. Recently, the Bulletin updated its Doomsday Clock. It's now just 2.5 minutes to midnight, the closest it's been since the first tests of thermonuclear bombs in 1953. Chief among their reasons was a series of remarks President Trump had made on the campaign trail about his approach to the management and use of nuclear weapons. But how much of that rhetoric will really translate to U.S. nuclear policy? Is there really so much reason for concern? Hello and welcome to the Harvard Kennedy School PolicyCast. I'm your host, Matt Cadwallader, and joining us today is HKS Professor Matthew Bunn, a renowned expert on nuclear security, who's the co-principal investigator of the Belfer Center's project on managing the atom. He's also the editor of the recent book, Insider Threats. Professor, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
So perhaps the largest responsibility bestowed upon any new president is their control of the U.S. nuclear arsenal. Can you describe how it is that the U.S. government manages the nuclear arsenal right now and what happens when a new president comes in?
Well, there's going to be some huge decisions that the Trump administration is going to have to make on this. It's an irony of history that Barack Obama, the president who won a Nobel Peace Prize for his soaring disarmament rhetoric, is also the president who laid out literally a $1 trillion program to modernize every aspect of the U.S. nuclear stockpile. So the way it works is the deployed weapons on missiles and bombers and things and submarines and so on are managed by the Department of Defense. But the nuclear weapons complex that maintains the nuclear weapons, that assembles and disassembles nuclear weapons, that produces and manages the nuclear material, that's all under the Department of Energy. That dates back from the very earliest days of the nuclear age when the atomic scientists said, you know, it really shouldn't be the military solely in charge of this new, unbelievably powerful weapon. So we have this substantial nuclear complex with 3 nuclear weapons laboratories, a number of nuclear facilities managing the plutonium and the highly enriched uranium that you need for nuclear weapons. That's all under the Department of Energy, where Rick Perry has been nominated to be Secretary of Energy.
Mm-hmm. Of course, the former governor of Texas, he's preceded by two, I believe they're nuclear physicists, who were secretaries of energy before, Ernest Moniz most recently from MIT. What does that mean for the Department of Energy, you know, to have somebody who doesn't necessarily come from that scientific background in that position?
Well, to be fair, it's happened before. We've had people ranging from lawyers to dentists as secretaries of energy in the past. Ernie Moniz brought an amazing collection of skills to the job, really deep knowledge of the technical issues that the department oversees, combined with remarkable political and negotiation and bureaucratic infighting skills. And that's why, for example, Ernie Moniz ended up sort of co-negotiating with John Kerry, the Secretary of State, the nuclear deal with Iran. And many of the most important technical provisions of that deal were negotiated one-on-one between Ernie Moniz and the head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, who ironically got his PhD from MIT. So it was two MIT men negotiating with each other. So we'll have a different arrangement with Rick Perry as Secretary of Energy. I think it will make it even more important who is head of the allegedly semi-autonomous but really integrated within the Department of Energy, National Nuclear Security Administration, which is the part of the department that actually manages the nuclear weapons complex and also manages the very important programs that the department has for working with other states to strengthen their controls over preventing the spread of nuclear weapons and related technologies. So the Department of Energy, somewhat surprisingly, is only modestly involved in energy. Most of the budget is either nuclear weapons, nuclear nonproliferation, nuclear cleanup, or science. So the Department of Energy runs a lot of the nation's high energy physics work and some other areas of science as well.
So you mentioned the $1 trillion 30-year project to modernize the U.S. nuclear arsenal. I think in a previous episode of this podcast, we interviewed the Secretary of the Air Force, and she essentially made the case for it, saying that, this is our deterrence capability and we need to maintain that. Still, that is a lot of money. That's a long-term plan. Is this really a necessary project for the United States to be pursuing?
So it seems clear that we're going to need to modernize our nuclear forces in some way. We have submarines that are reaching the end of their operational lives. We have bombers that in some cases not only are older than the people flying them, but we have at least some bombers where the pilot's father piloted the same aircraft. And there's at least a possibility that the last B-52 pilot has not yet been born. So these are really old planes. So the ICBMs also are quite old, although in each of these cases, pieces have been replaced as we went. So it's not like, every piece is left over from the 1960s. So something is going to be need to be done. But what is proposed at the moment is essentially a newer, shinier version of exactly each kind of thing we had in the Cold War. And it's not obvious to me that with a different structure of international relations and radically different technologies in the world, that that's the right answer. And it's very surprising to me that we haven't had a broader national debate. There's been a little bit of debate among experts, but there's been almost no national debate about how many nuclear weapons do we need, of what kinds, for what purpose. And there are deep issues about those questions. There are people who think, a few hundred nuclear weapons would be fine. And there are other people who think, no, we need thousands of nuclear weapons of a wide variety of types to deal with the world that's out there. And we haven't really had that debate in a serious way.
It seems like when you talk about nuclear threats, you have the deterrence aspect with respect to, large-scale war. You also have terrorists who could potentially, find their way to develop some kind of nuclear capability, whether it be a nuclear weapon or a so-called dirty bomb. Does our nuclear arsenal have to prevent all those types of threats? I can't imagine that it's very good at preventing a terrorist attack.
So I would argue our nuclear weapons are utterly useless for preventing nuclear terrorism. What prevents nuclear terrorism is making sure it's really two things. First, going after the high-capability terrorist groups, which are the only ones that could plausibly get into the nuclear business, because it's not easy to make a nuclear bomb. Unfortunately, repeated government studies have concluded that if a sophisticated terrorist group got hold of highly enriched uranium or plutonium, the key nuclear materials, that they might well be able to make a crude nuclear bomb. So locking down those materials all over the world is absolutely crucial. And we've been doing a lot on that over the course of the last quarter century. And President Obama launched this series of global nuclear security summits to focus on that effort. But there is more to be done. And in particular, one of the unfortunate aspects of the crisis in U.S.-Russian relations that's been taking place over the last couple of years is an almost complete cutoff of cooperation on both nuclear security and nuclear energy, nuclear science. In essence, the nuclear experts in the United States and Russia are practically prohibited from even talking to each other. Mm-hmm. And that's foolish and unwise for the world's two largest nuclear stockpiles to be being managed in isolation without the experts in those two countries sort of talking to each other, sharing ideas about how to address common problems is dangerous for everyone. So I'm hopeful that with a new president who appears to want to have better relations with Russia, that we may be able to find our way back to at least cooperating in those ways. But so you want to take on the high capability terrorist groups, and you want to make sure that the nuclear material can't get loose and get into the hands of these groups, because without that material, they can't make a bomb.
It seems like the most threatening time for that to have been a problem was right after the Cold War.
Indeed.
Breakup of the Soviet Union,
Indeed.
Tremendous number of countries with...
So when I got involved in the early 90s, right after the collapse of the Soviet Union, it really was a frightening situation. There were gaping holes and fences at nuclear facilities. There were
literally
many places with no detector at all to set off an alarm if someone were carrying plutonium out in their briefcase. There was highly enriched uranium and what you and I would consider a high school gym locker with a padlock that could be snapped with a bolt cutter from any hardware store. And there was, you know, highly enriched uranium showing up in parked cars in Prague. When I was in the White House science office working on these issues, it was not that unusual for me to wake up in the middle of the night in a cold sweat thinking, you know, the bad guys are going to get the stuff before we finish the security upgrades and we're not doing enough. And fortunately, the really egregious problems have been fixed. Mm-hmm. But the problem is that more sophisticated efforts to steal nuclear material, where you have perhaps an insider conspiring with outsiders or a couple of insiders conspiring together and really thinking through their plan, you really need to work hard to secure this stuff. And you can't get to a point where you say, okay, it's good enough, I'm done. This is something like nuclear safety where you have to focus on continuous improvement, because if you're not getting better, you're probably getting worse. You need to be constantly evolving in the face of an evolving threat, changing technology, and the constant process of finding vulnerabilities that you hadn't thought of before. Mm-hmm. One of my colleagues has a wonderful set of security maxims that are available on the web. And one of them is what he calls the infinity maxim, which is his view is that any real security system has an infinite number of vulnerabilities, most of which will never be found either by the good guys or the bad guys.
In the last quarter century, the number of countries that have nuclear capability has essentially remained unchanged. And I think that would be a victory for non-proliferation. But at the same time, we now have a president who has, you know, he's spoken very clearly about his unhappiness with the fact that many countries have benefited from U.S. protection without necessarily, in his estimation, paying their fair share. Countries that have, you know, benefited from the U.S. nuclear umbrella, is the retraction of that umbrella going to be a threat to that stability that we've seen over the last 25 years?
So I don't think we should exaggerate the importance of things the president said during his campaign.
I was talking about his inauguration speech.
Well, even in his inauguration speech, you know, yes, he emphasized America first, but he also said we're going to strengthen old alliances and we're going to build new alliances. And both the Secretary of State designate and the now sworn-in Secretary of Defense emphasized the importance of U.S. alliances. Secretary of Defense Mattis, said, who is a deep scholar of military history, said, my observation is that countries with allies thrive and countries without allies don't. And I think that's absolutely correct. If you look historically, the United States has used its power again and again to prevent its allies from getting nuclear weapons, both by offering its umbrella, which I think is not going to be retracted, and by some really forceful coercion of allies. So, you know, South Korea and Taiwan, for example, both twice had secret nuclear weapons programs that the United States found out about and went in and stomped on with great vigor and, you know, really fairly forceful coercion. I think we're in better shape now than we were when those things happened in the 70s and 80s. You do have a fair amount of sort of loose talk in South Korea about nuclear weapons, but I don't think South Korea is going to be pursuing nuclear weapons anytime soon, and I don't think Japan's going to be pursuing nuclear weapons anytime soon. You know, it's an amazing public policy success story that over the last quarter century, we've had no net increase in the number of states with nuclear weapons. North Korea added itself to the list, but South Africa became the first case of real nuclear disarmament where a country that had, you know, developed and built its own nuclear weapons took them apart and, you know, under verification. We have more states that started nuclear weapons programs and verifiably gave them up than we have states with nuclear weapons, which means our efforts to talk countries out of it succeed more often than they fail, even in the fairly rare cases where countries start down the road in the first place. So the notion that, you know, the bomb is completely out of the barn and anybody who wants one can get one is just not correct. Our efforts to control the spread of nuclear weapons have been astonishingly successful. And I think, you know, of course, past performance is no guarantee of future success. But we, if we follow sensible policies, and admittedly that's a big if in the stage that we're in, I think there's a decent chance that 25 years from now we will still have the same number of nuclear weapon states or maybe even fewer.
Mm-hmm. Now, can you talk a little bit about the threats that we do face? Obviously, you know, the last couple of years saw the Iran nuclear deal. That was a big deal. But, of course, that has also been rejected by Trump on the campaign trail. And you also, you mentioned, you know, North Korea has nuclear weapon capability now. They're trying to develop ability to, you know, have missiles that can reach the United States or at least the continental United States. Can you talk about those threats and what it is that we need to do to address them?
So the reality is the Trump administration is going to face a complex set of nuclear threats across the globe. In North Korea, we have a very unpredictable dictator with a fast developing nuclear and missile program. More missile tests in 2016 than ever before, working to, as you say, to get intercontinental missiles that could hit the continental United States. The Trump administration is going to have to decide what to do about that. But also, you know, there's real potential for inadvertently blundering into war on the Korean Peninsula. The South Koreans are sick and tired of sitting back every time the North commits some terrible provocation like sinking one of their ships and really believe the next time, you know, they're going to hit them harder than they've been hit. And I would imagine the North Korean regime being what it is, that they would feel they had to strike back in some very forceful way if the South were to strike them. And you could imagine escalating up to a large-scale conflict. And, you know, that could be a very terrible conflict. In addition to the nuclear weapons, the North has over 10,000 artillery troops trained on Seoul. Meanwhile, we have the situation with Iran, which had a very threatening nuclear program, which they described as civilian, but, you know, they had done pretty clearly work on developing the technology for nuclear weapons and the allegedly civilian technology they were using, they said, to produce fuel for nuclear reactors, the centrifuges, were exactly what you needed also to produce nuclear bomb fuel. Now, the Iran nuclear deal rolled back the number of centrifuges by two-thirds, got rid of about 98% of the enriched uranium that would otherwise have given them a head start on making bomb material, and opened them up to much broader verification than before, and cut off the plutonium route almost completely. But many of those restraints on enrichment expire in a number of years, even if the deal survives. And it's not clear that deal is going to survive. The, as you said, the president-elect called it the worst deal ever negotiated. On the now the president called it the worst deal ever negotiated. And on the other hand, his Secretary of State and Secretary of Defense in their confirmation hearings said that it ought to be continued. Very likely Congress is going to pass sanctions legislation targeted on Iranian missile testing. The Iranians will see that as a violation of our obligations under the deal. It's not exactly, but it's easy to interpret it that way. It will come in the middle of the Iranian presidential elections and may undermine the moderates in Iran in favor of the hardliners. So it's not at all clear what's going to happen with the Iranian nuclear deal. Meanwhile, in South Asia, Pakistan and India are building up their nuclear forces. These are countries that have fought four wars with each other. Even a relatively modest nuclear exchange between India and Pakistan, not only could it kill a horrifying number of people in that country, but the latest modeling suggests that it might be able to cause what some people call a nuclear fall or nuclear autumn that would put up enough smoke into the upper atmosphere to cool the whole northern hemisphere, interfere with agriculture for a couple of years across the northern hemisphere, potentially put of order a billion people at risk of starvation. So there's a reason for us to care about what happens in India, Pakistan, even beyond our human feeling for what might happen to the immediate victims in such a conflict. And meanwhile, in Europe, we have this very tense situation for the present with Russia. Russia has really broken the rules that have existed since World War II by seizing territory by force in the Crimea and destabilizing eastern Ukraine with troops. You could imagine similar things happening in the Baltics, which are our NATO allies. And, in the combination of somewhat difficult to control technologies like cyber and other, inadvertent escalation, you can imagine a conflict starting small and escalating out of control. And the Russians have a doctrine that they've exercised, that they've written about in their strategic doctrine that involves basically using nuclear weapons fairly early in a conflict in a small way to scare NATO off. Some people call it escalate to de-escalate. And of course, the dangers of that are absolutely enormous. So we've got a lot of nuclear challenges that we're facing in the world that exists today.
What does modern nuclear warfare look like, or a modern nuclear capacity look like? Does it involve the largest possible bombs going off in population centers? Is it smaller nuclear weapons that are more strategic?
Well, it depends on your perspective as to what's large and small. So the nuclear weapons today are a good bit smaller than the largest ones we had in the Cold War, which, we had, for example, nuclear weapons on ICBMs that had a yield of 9 million tons of conventional explosives. But even the ones that we have today, which are more like 500,000 tons or 250,000 tons, are hugely larger than the bombs that obliterated Hiroshima and Nagasaki in World War II. I sometimes have my students, just to give them a feeling of scale, do a calculation of how long would a train be carrying the equivalent conventional explosives of the Hiroshima bomb, mm-hmm. Which again is much smaller than most of our nuclear weapons today. And the answer is about a mile and a half train of just packed with nothing but explosives. Wow. I mean, these are immensely powerful weapons. So even though today nuclear weapons aren't mostly intentionally targeted on cities, mm-hmm. they nonetheless are targeted on industrial targets that would support a war effort and so on. And hundreds of millions of people would die if the full nuclear arsenals of the United States and Russia, which still have over 90% of the world's nuclear weapons, mm-hmm. Were ever used. There are still thousands of nuclear weapons ready for immediate launch in the world today. And there are over 15,000 that still physically exist in the world today, some of which are just sitting waiting to be dismantled. But still, it was an insane number during the Cold War, and it's doubly insane 25 years after the Cold War that number of nuclear weapons still exists.
Right. So what is it that the Trump administration should be most concerned with right now in terms of the threats, in terms of the management within the United States? On nuclear security, are there things that need to be undertaken immediately?
I think so. I think they need to revitalize the U.S. programs on nuclear security, many of which have been cut back as cooperation with Russia was cut off and progress in a number of other countries sort of slowed. I think that they need to figure out what approach are they going to take to North Korea. I believe that under the current North Korean regime, there's no real possibility that we're going to get complete denuclearization under North Korea, and that we have to focus, for the time being at least, on getting some kind of a freeze negotiated that would cap North Korea's further missile testing, nuclear testing, production of additional nuclear material, and so on. I believe they should try to maintain the nuclear deal with Iran and figure out what steps we can take in the near term while those key restraints of that deal are in place to try to reduce the risks to U.S. security that will otherwise exist when those restraints expire. In other words, rather than playing the short game with Iran and ripping up the deal right now, and we ought to be playing the long game and thinking about what can we do to most reduce the risk that 10 years from now, 20 years from now, 30 years from now, Iran would have nuclear weapons. And we ought to be working with Pakistan and India to try to end that nuclear arms competition that exists there while attempting to rescue and rebuild the structure of arms control that has existed with Russia these many years. The reality is that structure, while there is this new START agreement that the Obama administration put in place, which I think is important to maintain, Russia has been violating the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Agreement that was sort of the first modern arms control agreement that included on-site inspection, and has charged that the United States is also violating that agreement. And some of their charges are nonsense, but at least one of their charges, if the shoe were on the other foot, we'd be banging our spoon about their violation. So there's a lot to do to just strengthen the basic structures that have held things in place so far.
Well, Professor Matthew Bunn, thank you so much for joining us on PolicyCast today. I really appreciate it.
All right. Thank you.
Professor Matthew Bunn is the co-principal investigator for the Belfer Center's Project on Managing the Atom. You can find a link to his recently edited book, Insider Threats, in the show notes. HKS PolicyCast is a production of Harvard Kennedy School. I'm your host, Matt Cadwallader. Natalie Montana is our guest wrangler, Sarah Abrams, our sage advisor, and Becky Wickel, our digital guru. Send us your comments and questions to policycast@hks.harvard.edu or on Twitter @policycast and subscribe on iTunes and elsewhere by visiting hkspolicycast.org. See you next week.